We're going to call the Judiciary Committee meeting together. It's about 1:37 on Friday afternoon, the 22nd. With us is Senator Olson. We have Senator Dyson and Chairman Colgill. We had a couple of things I'd like to get done very rapidly, if you don't mind. I have two members up for confirmation, for legislative ethics, and let's see, one was the Judicial Conduct Commission. I have a lady online from New York, and I don't want to hold her on too long, so I'd like to get to the confirmations. I have Janine Leisk. I'm sorry I messed that up. Janine, are you online?
I'm sorry?
Good afternoon. Jeannie, why don't you go ahead and put yourself on the record and the position that you've been appointed to.
Thank you. My name is Janie Leisk, L-E-A-S-K. I'm from Anchorage, and I am, my application is for, as an alternate to the Legislative Ethics Committee.
Well, first of all, thank you for being willing to serve. It's been my privilege to serve on the Ethics Committee some years now. And have you been in an Ethics Committee process before?
No, I haven't.
Oh, well, you will find this an interesting process. Was there some question in your mind? Did you volunteer for this, or did somebody volunteer you?
Oh, somebody suggested me, and I was I'm very interested in it. I believe in public service in the highest sense of the word, and find this would be a very interesting fit for me.
Well, I was reading your resume, and you certainly have a good presence in both the management, the business world, and working with a diversity of people. So I think it's going to be perfect. Is there any questions? Senator Dyson has a question for you, Janie.
Actually, I do not, except to say hello, and I'm glad you're doing this.
Oh, thank you, Senator. Yes.
And I
you know, if confirmed, I really look forward to it.
Yeah, and aside from the qualities that the chairman recognized, I'd like the committee to know that this lady is very bright.
Thank you. Janie, why don't you say your last name one more time so I don't get it wrong next time I say it.
Leisk, L-E-A-S-K, and it's with a long E.
All right, got it. Any other questions? First of all, thanks for taking the time out to actually call into the committee. I know that scheduling can be interesting, and it's going to be a quick one. Is there any further questions? What I'm going to do is I'm going to hold off the motion until we've gone to Mr. Brown. Thank you very much for joining us, Janie, and I appreciate it. I look forward to seeing you somewhere around dealing with ethics.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. We also have Chris Brown on. Chris Brown has been nominated to work in the Commission on Judicial Conduct. Are you on, Chris?
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, and good afternoon, Senators Olson, Dyson, and Cobb-Kill. This is Chris Brown.
And just to let you know, we've been joined by in the committee with Senator Wilkowski.
Okay, good afternoon to you as well, Senator Wilkowski. I'm looking for the confirmation to serve a second term now on the Commission for Judicial Conduct. I believe I've added value in the last 4 years. I've enjoyed greatly my involvement with the officers of the court, both the lawyers and the judges, in the last 4 years. It's been a very interesting time, and one that has been encouraging to me to see how well that process can work. So I look forward to the opportunity, should I be confirmed, to serve another 4 years.
Mr. Brown, first of all, thank you for being willing to serve. Is there any questions for Mr. Brown? Senator Olson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Brown, I see that you've got a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering. I find that pretty interesting that somebody with that kind of a background in education would be volunteering for judicial conduct in a position like this one.
Well, yeah, thanks, Senator Olson. I started my education with a degree in electronic engineering and actually went back to business school, and I jokingly describe myself as a recovering engineer these days.
Well, thank you very much for serving, and I extend that to you as well.
Thank you.
And Mr. Brown, thank you for taking the time out to call into the committee. I don't see any other questions, so I wish you well, and with gratitude from this committee, what I'd like at this point is to have a motion to go ahead and move these on to the body for further consideration by the full body.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I move that we move the nomination of James Brown to the Commission on Judicial Conduct and Janie Leask as an alternate on the Ethics Committee, and our approval does not bind any of the members of this committee to voting for their confirmation before the full body.
Thank you. Is there any objection? At this point, then at the end of the committee, we have a note for you to sign to move them on to the full body for consideration. Thank you very much. And my apologies for moving along fast, but I do have somebody online from across the country. Diane Ravitch is in New York. Diane, can you hear us all right?
Hi, this is Diane Ravitch.
So, Diane, in a moment I'll have you introduce yourself. This is with regard to Senate Joint Resolution number 9, and really the question has been the policy question in amending the Constitution. And Diane, why don't you put yourself on the record by your name and any affiliation, and then give us your testimony, please.
Certainly. My name is Diane Ravitch, R-A-V-I-T-C-H. I'm a research professor at New York University and have an extensive background as a historian of education.
Thank you. Just give us your testimony, and if you could, it's a little light. I can't hear you very well.
Okay, I'll try to speak up. I want you to hear what I have to say.
Thank you very much.
I am a historian of education. I've studied the history of American education for 40 years. I served as Assistant Secretary of Education for Research in the administration of President George H.W. Bush. President Clinton then appointed me to the National Assessment Governing Board. That's the board that oversees national testing. So I come to the issues with a bipartisan perspective. I also had a decade or more working as an active participant in some very conservative think tanks in Washington and California, with which I'm no longer affiliated, and these think tanks are very strong advocates of vouchers. So I understand why some people want vouchers, and I have to say that based on my own study, I am very much opposed to vouchers. I believe that they will undermine and destroy the public education system. And I believe, based on my many years of study, that public education is one of the essential institutions of a democratic society, and that we would be very foolish to harm our public education system. This is a very diverse nation, and public schools are the institution that was created to teach us to live together. Vouchers, I want to add, are not scholarships. They're often called opportunity scholarships. They're vouchers. They're a way to use public money to pay for religious and private education, and they don't work. I just today received a bulletin from Henry Levin, who's a distinguished professor of research in international studies at Columbia University, and he just participated in a meeting in Sweden of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences. They held a two-day conference to discuss what vouchers had accomplished. Sweden adopted vouchers in 1992, and in 1995, their test scores started dropping in reading and science and in mathematics, and they have dropped from 1995 to the present, and all of the international tests given in these subjects of reading, math, and science. They also in Sweden were very concerned because as a result of the privatization brought on by vouchers, they found that there was increased segregation of students by socioeconomic status and by ethnicity over the period in which they've had vouchers. They're also, the additional concern is that there are very large profits being amassed by the independent schools using and consuming public funds. So the problem is, I think, very well outlined in Sweden, but it's a problem that we will face in this country. There are several states now that have adopted vouchers. Not a one of the voucher programs now in use have been adopted by a vote of the people. American people don't want vouchers. Every time they've been put to a vote, they've been turned down. Most recently, the vote was taken in Florida, which is a red state, and it was turned down by the American by the people of Florida by 58-42. There are currently three urban districts that have vouchers: Milwaukee, Cleveland, and the District of Columbia. These are three of the nation's lowest performing districts, and the one that's had vouchers the longest is Milwaukee. Milwaukee has now three sectors. It has the public sector, which is shrinking, a very vigorous charter sector, and a vigorous voucher sector. They're all competing. They're all low performing. They're all three sectors get about the same test scores. And black kids in Milwaukee are supposed to be the beneficiaries of all these vouchers, and they're among the lowest performing in the nation. So after 22 years of vouchers and charters, black kids in Milwaukee are performing on the same level as black kids in Mississippi. I know that some of the supporters of vouchers say, well, the test scores may be stagnant and the test scores may be low, but the graduation rates are higher in the voucher schools. But what they won't tell you is that the attrition rate from the voucher schools is so high that the graduation rate is meaningless. In Milwaukee, since they started the voucher program, the evaluation there, which was done, by the way, by a voucher supporter, showed that 75% of the kids who started in ninth grade had dropped out before the end of 12th grade. 75% dropped out before the end of 12th grade. So to say that the graduation rate was higher is meaningless because you're only talking about the 25% who persisted. Another form of voucher that has been recently popular is the voucher for children with special needs. And this started in Florida under Governor Jeb Bush, and it's called the McKay Scholarship Program. And there was an expose of this program. It's cost the state over $1 billion in so-called scholarships, but they're vouchers for children with special needs. And many of these kids with disabilities are going to schools with no curriculum, schools run by people lacking any educational credentials and having teachers with no certification. It was really the article about this, which won an award, one of the highest awards from the journalist, the Sigma Delta Chi Society of Journalists. The article was called "The McKay Scholarship Program Sparks a Cottage Industry of Fraud and Chaos." I think it would be a terrible thing to send special ed kids into schools where there are not credentialed teachers and not and no curriculum and so forth. So if you ask the question, are children learning more as a result of vouchers, the answer from Milwaukee, Washington, and Cleveland is no, they're not. If you ask about what about the role of public education in a democracy, think about it. All of the great social movements of the past half century came through the public schools. Racial desegregation, gender equity, the inclusion of students with disabilities, all of this happened through public education, not through private schools or voucher schools. So what I see looking around the country at these states that are have expanded vouchers or considering vouchers is that the pushback is coming not just from Democrats, but from Republicans from rural districts. In Texas, where I was a couple of weeks ago, the opposition to vouchers is coming from Republicans who are concerned that vouchers will destroy their local community public schools. They come from districts with one school or two or three schools. They don't want to see their local public schools destroyed by people taking the vouchers off the church schools. In Wisconsin, where there's an effort to expand the voucher program, Republicans from rural districts are saying they don't want a further expansion of vouchers because they say let our people vote first because they know their people will oppose them. As I said, vouchers have never been approved by popular vote. And the Republicans from rural districts are concerned about the destruction of their local community schools. I would say that you should be extremely cautious in going this direction because if you look to the highest performing nations in the world, whether it's Finland or Singapore or Japan, these are nations that have a strong public education system. Everybody works together in the best interest of the children. If people want to spend their own money to go to a religious school, that's their right, that's their privilege, but you shouldn't ask the government to pay for it. And that's my testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Diane. Is there questions that any would like to ask?
Yeah, thank you.
Senator Diane. Tyson.
Yeah, should I call you Dr. Revich?
Well, I don't know. I'll leave that up to you. I'm well, probably old enough to be your mother, but I guess you should.
Actually, in this case, not. I'm really old, but I appreciate your work and your scholarship. The issue before us is really about a clarification of our Constitution. Are you familiar with our Constitution?
No, I'm not, sir.
All right. How about, have you studied education here in Alaska much?
Well, you know, I've studied Alaska across the country, and I know of many different states, and I would assume that you have the same kinds of public schools that most do. And I don't know whether you have a Blaine Amendment. Most of the states have something called a Blaine Amendment, where they are forbidden from funding religious schools. And the effort to establish vouchers usually involves a constitutional amendment to remove the Blaine Amendment.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. And there are a variety of legal opinions on that. It seems to me, and I don't want to put words in your mouth or any of the critics, but the ultimate, it would seem to me, if you chase the logic down, that finally it's the position that we really can't trust the majority of parents to make wise decisions on where they place their kids in the educational system. Am I being unfair?
Well, sir, I don't think that's exactly right, because in Louisiana, for example, where they offered half the children in the state a voucher, only 2% chose to exercise taking a voucher. And I think that if we really trust parents, we would allow them to vote on this.
Yeah.
And the fact is that, as I pointed out in my testimony, the American people, state after state, has had a referendum, and vouchers have never passed.
Yeah, we have a recent poll that shows here in Alaska that something around 56% of the folks approve parents having some kind of choice. Another fundamental question, and this is not a pejorative question, but I personally am quite uncomfortable about government having control over virtually all education and thereby hugely being able to influence the thinking of our children. Do I have a wrong presupposition from your perspective?
Well, having been very involved in this field since the late 1960s, I understand where you're coming from, but I have not seen any evidence that government makes any effort to propagandize children and teach them to have a particular point of view. I think quite the opposite, that when you have voucher schools, the kids are more likely to go to schools where they're being taught a particular point of view, whether it's religious or political. Whereas in a government school, the emphasis, at least as far as I've seen it in this country, is on teaching children to debate and to hear different sides of the question. And I've been very struck traveling around the country that in every school I've ever been in, the emphasis was on what's the other side? Let's hear both sides of the question. And I think that's what makes for an intelligent citizenry.
Yeah, and I hope you're right. My own view is there's no education that is value-free. And one of the results I've seen in my own school district, which is the largest in Alaska, is when I've questioned a school about teaching ethics and values, and I'm thinking particularly here about teaching kids about how they treat their own bodies in terms of psychoactive drugs and sexual behavior and so on and so forth. And you know, they certainly said, and I believe them, that they really want to teach them to take good care of their health and everything. But on the second question of sexual ethics and so on, I was told by a couple of administrators that parents don't really want us to teach our kids values. And yet, I think all of us want our kids to be taught some values, some of the core values of our culture.
Well, Senator, I certainly agree with you, and I think that is first and foremost a family responsibility, and also that's something where the churches and people should definitely teach their kids values. I think where you get into trouble is when you get people having no values at all, and then expecting, and then they get angry when the teachers, either they think they should be imposing values or they shouldn't be. I think it's the role of the public school to teach children to think very seriously about the consequences of their behavior. And I would, I as a parent and now a grandparent, will be very happy because I've had kids in private schools and I've had kids in public schools, and I have, my grandchild is now in public school. I want them to teach my grandchild to think seriously about the consequences of his behavior, and I think that's the most important kind of value.
Yeah, and the only reason I disagree is I actually think that truth and values, carefully analyzed, are transcendent and true in all places, at all time, for all people. But thank you for your testimony and for helping us out.
Well, thank you, Senator.
Any other questions? Diane, I really appreciate you taking the time out of your now evening to join us. And is there a way that you can bring maybe a portion of your written testimony or a written document to this committee?
I'd be glad to do that. I could summarize what I just said and send it to whoever. I should just have someone send me an email and tell me where to send it, and I'll submit that as testimony.
I will get the address and make sure that it gets to you. I appreciate that. I'd like to make that a part of the record. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, and thank you for including me. And I know you live in the most beautiful state in all of the nation, so I wish that I were with you, but unfortunately, I'm in New York.
Oh, that's a nice
so
compliment.
Thank you, sir.
That's a nice compliment,
okay,
and believe me, we enjoy it. And the sun's shining up here right now. Thank you, Diane. Thank you very much. We have some more. Did I have the sponsor show up?
Yes.
Okay. Why don't you come on forward for just a moment? Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
What I'm looking at here is it looks like I have the commissioner testify, and I was going to kind of watch and see who else that you had specifically set up, because I tried to set up as much time as I could for you to bring in some professional voices for your side. Certainly, Diane Ravitch had a different perspective, no doubt about it.
I missed that. Was she on our side?
No, she was not. Sorry to say. But I wanted to make sure that I got the written testimony, because I know you missed a good portion of her testimony. We'll make sure that you have that for your perusal as well as our committee. I was going to go ahead and ask the commissioner to come up, but I just wanted to make sure we are on track with what you're thinking.
Yes. Yep.
All right. Okay. All right. I have Commissioner Handley. Did you want to come testify on this, or were you here for questions?
Largely for questions, for anything the committee needs.
All right. Is there any questions for the commissioner? Yes, we have a couple of people that would like to ask you questions. Just put yourself on the record, Commissioner.
Thank you, Senator. For the record, my name is Mike Hanley. I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Education and Early Development.
Thank you very much for coming to committee. Senator Wilkowski, have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, do you know how many children in Alaska go to private schools? Do we keep records on that, or private religious schools?
Through the chair, we don't keep records on private school students. There's an estimate in the ballpark of 7,000 to 8,000.
And the average amount that is spent for the foundation formula is what? About a little bit less than 6,000, I think.
That's the base student, and then we have the cost differentials. But yes,
Mr. Chair, if I could, sure. If you were to take $6,000 per 7,000 students, and you were to pull out basically $42 million or so from the budget, would that have an impact on the public education system, in your opinion?
Through the chair, the legislature is fully responsible for the funding of education and determining where those funds go. So it funds students in if they were to fund students, they would be part of public education. So I don't see how that would be a negative impact. Would it fund more students? Yes, it would.
Have you, Mr. If I could, have, sure. Has your department run any sort of analysis to try to figure out what the impact would be on the public education system if we were to fully fund all those kids in private schools? Have you run any sort of analysis if you lost $42 million out of the current education system?
Through the chair, we haven't, because my understanding is this resolution deals with the constitutional amendment rather than a funding component. So the fiscal, there is no fiscal analysis that we have in regards to that, in regards to this resolution.
If I could, Mr. Chair, does your do you have any opinion on this, on whether or not we should pass this?
I do. When I look at our responsibilities as a state, my responsibilities as a commissioner, to offer an appropriate education for our students, I think we have also have the obligation to do that in the most the way that will provide the best outcomes for our students. And I think providing choice for our students is a valuable way to do that. So I'm supportive of this particular resolution.
And then, if I could, Mr. Chair, if you're supportive and you haven't run any sort of financial implications on what would happen if we ultimately passed it, you're assuming you're supportive because you think it would offer choice to kids, which means that we're going to be funding private education. And I'm trying to get down and understand what the financial implications are if we do actually pass this and implement this to its full extent. Is it possible for you to run some sort of analysis to see where there would be cuts or what the impact of the cuts would be before we vote on this?
Through the chair, I think that we're looking at the next step of potentially a bill that would allow for vouchers, as opposed to what I see before us. My understanding is this resolution being a constitutional amendment. Would the next step move towards that? It surely seems that it would be likely to go in that regard. The simplest math would be the one that you suggested, is how many private school students are there multiplied times a BSA. I think it really becomes up to the legislature then to how to fund education. Do we add to that? It seems to be that there's a perception that there's a deficit there, that there's money removed, and I don't know that that's necessarily the case.
And Mr. Chair, and we all talk about how we're in a period of declining revenues and declining oil, and so I'm not even factoring in the number of new students who may take advantage of that, which do you have any sense of whether it's 5%, 10%, 20% of the total kids in the public school system right now who would take advantage of a voucher program?
Through the chair, I it would be pure speculation. I would have no idea. Since we haven't had a voucher system here previously, I would have no idea of how many students would move from a public school to a private school. I wouldn't even venture a guess.
I think, you know, that might be a good question that we and I might actually ask along the way. It doesn't have to be anytime real soon, but it would be interesting information to find how many school-age children to date are not in our public school system. And I don't know that that's necessarily your responsibility, but there may be ways for us to kind of dig into that, because I think the impact could be one of two ways. How many children do not get any help from the state, number one, and then how many children may be pulled out of one type of school and put into another? And that would be a probably an entirely different question. But I think it's a legitimate question, Ms. Senator Wilkowski, is how many children right now are not involved in the public school system, and yet somehow the state is paying for their education anyway, and yet they're not getting the benefit of it. So I think that's one of the questions. It's a good one. So, Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, follow up. If there were a proposal on the table today to cut $42 million out of the education budget, is that something that you or the administration would support? If yes, why? If no, why?
through the chair, the funding component really lies with the legislature rather than with the Department of Education. And
But you're the commissioner. I mean, do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing? You're the guy in charge of education in Alaska. Is it a good thing to cut $42 million from public education? Yes or no?
I think that's a relatively rhetorical question, but yes, we'd see significant negative impacts if $42 million was cut from the education budget.
Tell me about the negative impacts you'd see.
It depends on where they were allocated. I would imagine that we would have to see, it would probably have to go to the formula. I think the legislature would have to make a decision. I don't know that there's $42 million. When we look at our agency component, there just is not that much federal or state funding, general fund, that goes to our agency. Our agency has largely a large amount of federal funding, so it would pretty much there wouldn't be a Department of Education if we were to take it all there. So I think it would have to fall to formula funds.
Senator Dyson, you had a question?
Actually, Mr. Chairman, on that point, I'd just like to point out that being a member of the Finance Committee for the last 13 years, the funding on that goes out there is determined by the Finance Committee and not by the Department of Education. And so we decide where the cuts are going to be to a certain degree. You do the fine-tuning over there, but that's the real answer to the question.
All right. Thank you. Senator Dyson, did I see your hand go up? All right.
No, it's a good time for me to keep my mouth shut.
Senator Wilcox.
I've got a question, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. Senator Wilcox.
Going back to these private schools, where are the private schools? Because they don't certainly seem to be out in rural Alaska. I'm not familiar with anyone except St. Mary's and Covenant High School that closed down 30 years ago. Where are they?
Right. Through the chair, I don't keep track of private schools, but I think you're correct. I think they're largely in urban areas.
Okay. And how many of those schools you don't keep track of them, but you must have a better idea than I do because you are an educator, right? And you're the top educator, right, of the state system here. How many of these private schools are not church affiliated? Or maybe it's something I should be asking the sponsor. And so if you don't know the answer, I can ask him.
I couldn't tell you off the top of my head.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, that's a good question, because in order to have the discussion broadly in public, those are some of the answers we're going to have to find for them to make a policy call and change in their constitution. Sure. So, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Can you talk a little bit about some of the village, how the village school systems work? And it's my understanding that when you get below a certain number of students in a school, then the schools cease to exist. I mean, is that something that, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Through the chair, the way our funding operates is that there's a funding formula for to provide a school for communities where there are 10 students or more. When we drop below 10, there's a hold harmless for 3 years. So let's say you went to 9, that student that's not there, you'd still be funded at 0.75 of that student. And then for the second year, it dropped to 0.5 and then 0.25. And then, but the funding does reduce. The state doesn't close schools, but the funding does reduce once you drop below 10. And oftentimes, local school boards determine that closing a school is the most feasible response.
Is there...
On that point, Mr. Chairman?
Sure.
A school being shut down, though, is not the Department of Education's responsibility. That's decided by the local school district. Isn't that correct?
That's absolutely correct.
Sure. Okay. I just want to make sure that's clear.
The funding changes.
Right.
And then the local board makes a decision on how to operate.
Sure.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Wilkowski.
If there were a voucher system, is there a way that the state could ensure that there's no discrimination that's occurring? Religious discrimination or anything like that of that nature?
Through the chair, I would, with my confidence in the legislature, I would say yes, it would become part of the statutes in regards to how a voucher was implemented. I would anticipate that there would be open access. I would anticipate that it would meet federal IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities and Education Act. It would meet the opportunity for students of all races and religions. I would anticipate that the legislature would put into a voucher statute those things that would provide equal opportunity for students and not discriminatory.
Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Would there be a requirement if there were a voucher system that Students in private schools have to meet the same standardized testing and graduation requirements?
Through the chair, that would be fully up to the legislature on how they develop that voucher.
Is that something that you would encourage that we do?
Personally, I believe if we have public funds that they go to wherever they go, that we would expect a public outcome. When I look at the department's own responsibilities, constitutional responsibilities, to establish and maintain, and that's actually the state's responsibilities, establish and maintain a system of public education, the courts have determined that for the department that a function of that is oversight and support. And that we set standards, and that we provide assessments towards those standards, and that we adequately fund those. Those are the four components of establishing and maintaining a system of public education. So from my perspective, I would say, well, for me to be able to provide some oversight and support and to have standards, that I would say if public money were to go there, that I would anticipate to fulfill my role, that there would be those accountability measures in place.
Yeah, and I think for me, that's another debate, but I can envision one of the debates would be that question,
right?
Plus, do we do it by standards or by outcomes?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, those are some of the debates that would probably ensue. To me, that's exactly the kind of debate that I would like to see, and that's one of the reasons why I've been kind of supportive. I would like to see the outcomes discussion,
sure,
kind of be one of the main questions. So, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In rural Alaska, I know this is one of the concerns that I've heard. You have generally small populations. Do you envision very much competition with new schools and voucher schools, or maybe schools via computer, internet, in rural Alaska if a voucher program evolves?
A hypothetical question. Would it increase competition in rural Alaska? Is that the question?
Yes.
I would anticipate that there would be additional opportunities for students to take courses online, maybe enroll in schools online, that may not be available, although there are a lot of courses now already online through the Alaska Learning Network, which we call ACLIN, and we know that a lot of rural schools also offer their students courses through other online courses.
Yeah, and as I could see, Mr. Commissioner, is that it actually could increase the benefit to a student rather than limited. So I see that. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. I just encourage us not to stray from what our goal here is, talk about the constitutional amendment and the appropriateness. And my understanding is this, what we're proposing here at least clarifies what's already in the Constitution. There's varying opinions about, and other states and courts have found that with exactly our language, or even the ones that have indirect in the Constitution, that courts have held that indirect support is permissible. But all the discussions here about what might happen, and what might happen to budgets, and what might happen to students, and some misuse, you know, I think are premature. But back to Senator Olson's question. As Senator Olson knows, there was outstanding private schools here in the rural areas in Alaska, Covenant High and Victory High School, and Sheldon Jackson. What's the one I'm missing?
St. Mary's.
St. Mary's produced outstanding students and were well thought of, and it was a government/court action that stopped those and so on. But to the detriment of the people in those communities and so on. So anyways, there was certainly not a problem with the quality of the output with those schools, which were in rural Alaska and largely run by local people who proved themselves to be inordinately competent. But anyways, I would encourage us to stick to the constitutional issue and at this time.
Well, and I'll just keep bringing back the constitutional question, but I will tell you this. Constitutional rule opens up possibilities, and I'm not afraid of looking at what are the potentials for a change in our Constitution. So I'm trying to be as broad as I can and allow as deep a question as I can, because to me what we're trying to do under this is say If there's limitations, maybe we can broaden it out. But if we broaden it out, do those limitations then go improper? And so I think it's appropriate discussion, though it's a potential discussion. So, Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, just on that point, Mr. Chair, we, as you know, this bill did have an education referral, and it was removed. And the way I thought we were proceeding was that we were going to be discussing the educational impacts. If that's no longer the case, then I would strongly urge that we add an education referral back to this. Are we discussing fully the educational impacts, or is this going to go back to the Education Committee at some point to discuss those, Mr. Chair?
Senator, it was my intention to go ahead and have as full a discussion as we can, both on education potential policy and the actual policy of this particular bill. So I am not trying to limit it. I want to keep one foot anchored on what the constitutional amendment actually does, but also allow a broad discussion on the potential. That's one of the reasons why I had this Diane Ravitch give as much time as I thought she could to make her case. So,
okay. Senator. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dyson.
I have some questions for the Commissioner, if
sure.
I may.
Yes, sir.
Do you understand what the administration's position is on putting this constitutional clarification or modification on the ballot?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, the governor has been very clear in public, quoted as saying he's very supportive of offering opportunities for students, additional choices for students, and really allowing the Alaskans, the people of Alaska, to make that decision.
Thank you. I understand that already DEED has several partnerships, if you will, with private institutions that provide educational services to the kids in Alaska. Is that true? And can you give us a list or an idea of who some of those are?
Through the chair, yes, we do. Probably the primary one is our pre-K program. We provide funding to districts. It was a competitive grant. We have a limited pre-K program. But then they partner with nonprofits, different nonprofits, Rural Cap and others, that provide the services at the ground level for students. The other one that is in our budget is like Parents as Teachers. It is also another partnership we have. Best Beginnings is also one. It's not quite the same kind of educational institution, but it's a supportive. There are public funds that go to that to support, you know, young children.
Yeah, thank you. And I understand that there are several education programs around that are kind of like apprenticeships, craft schools, teaching hands-on skills and so on. And those are getting public money or some in some form?
I'm through the chair, not directly from the Department of Education. So those decisions would be made at a local level. If a local school board superintendent said, look, we'd like to offer this hands-on, this vocational learning to students, that very well could be taking place. I don't know directly what those would be.
Yeah, and one of my children benefited greatly from being in a Slingerland school. Are those private?
In the past, Anchorage School District has had Slingerland classrooms within the school or within the school district. I'm not aware of any Slingerland schools out right now. There was one, Gateway was one, but that was a private school.
Yeah, I asked Vic Fisher when he was here, and we had a quite active discussion about this particular clause in the Constitution, and he held a strong position. But I asked him about the very issue that you and I are discussing, about these several things that that are private that are contributing, and it was an interesting answer. He said, I asked him if those were unconstitutional. He said, yeah, they are, but he said they've never been challenged because everybody likes them. And that was an interesting perspective from a man who might be the father of this very phrase in our Constitution. Are there any other private organizations that are that you all work with or partner with?
If we were to look at, through the chair, if we were to look at our correspondence programs, we believe that they fit within the Constitution. Otherwise, I'd be obligated to correct that. But there are programs like a Sylvan, like a tutoring center, where that we believe a student could access for tutoring and things like that. So we see those types of programs. Sometimes for special education, I say special, PE and things like that, art education, they might use a private vendor to access a particular course, and those are allowed.
So you would,
I think a last question, if I may.
All right.
As I understand it, in the school district you and I have been involved with, there was one charter school that was renting a church building and all their Sunday school classes and whatever for 4 or 5 years. I guess you could argue there was public money, the rent they were paying, that was going to the benefit of a private or religious organization that at least had their expenses deferred by it. You got a view on that one?
The conversation that we have, and it's largely around our correspondence programs, is what what institutes an educational institution, and or a private institution. Renting a facility, is that allowed, is that not allowed? Those are always a fine line, and we rely heavily on our counsel, our legal counsel, to make sure we follow law. So it's every situation is slightly different, and it's an ongoing challenge to find that line.
Commissioner, probably what I'm going to do at this point, if you could stick around to the end of our committee, but I do have somebody online that's in Colorado at this point, and I'd like to get him up, and then we can continue this discussion, if you don't mind. I have Martin Nussbaum, who's an attorney in Colorado, and was asked by the sponsor to come and talk to us, and I'd like to get him online, and then we can go back to some of the local education questions. Mr. Nussbaum, are you on? And please identify yourself.
I am. My name is Martin Nussbaum.
And just identify, you know, your affiliation, and then give us your testimony. Thank
well,
you.
I'm testifying this afternoon on behalf of the Alaska Policy Forum. Just a word or two about my background. I do religious liberty law and religious freedom law, so I'm deep in constitutional issues all the time, including issues related to the Blaine movement. So if I is now a good time to proceed with my testimony, Senator?
Absolutely, and thank you very much for taking your time to be with us.
You know, I had prepared a handout, and thank you for having me. I am honored to speak to you about this important issue, and I had prepared a handout. Does the committee have a copy of the handout that I had prepared?
We do. Thank you very much.
Okay. Is that I will be generally going through that, and I think it might be helpful. There's been a lot of talk about the Blaine movement, and it has worked out in a rather unusual way in Alaska that may be helpful for you, especially with regard to the constitutional issue before the committee. So I would like to start there. And so let's go back to 1874. At that time, there was a midterm election that was disastrous for the Republicans. Ulysses S. Grant was the president. His administration was riddled with as much scandal as any administration in American history, and enthusiasm for the Reconstruction Project was waning. So President Grant and a congressman, James Blaine, who had aspirations to run for president, they needed an issue to galvanize support to their party and to their side. So President Grant decided that the what we now call the Blaine Amendment would be a good issue to do that. What was happening demographically in the United States at that time is there were growing Catholic immigrations to the U.S. and the beginning, especially in major Catholic centers like Cincinnati, Boston, and elsewhere, construction of a Catholic school system, because the public school system at that time was largely Protestant in terms of its worldview and practices, the reading of the Protestant Bible, if you will. The King James Bible was active in the public schools. And the Catholics feared, or the Catholic leadership feared, that that an effect of the public schools would to Protestantize their members. And the Protestants feared, speaking generally, of course, that failing to have those students in those schools would fail to Americanize those students. So anyway, President Grant and Secretary Blaine introduced into Congress in late 1875 an amendment to the U.S. Constitution that we'll call the Blaine Amendment. And essentially what it did is it forbade the use of public funds in education for, quote, sectarian schools. Absolutely crystal clear in the history and the legislative history in the United States Senate that sectarian was code for Catholic. The bill passed the House overwhelmingly. It failed in the Senate by 4 votes. Most historians recognize that this was really a cynical play to get votes, because by the time of the final vote in the Senate, Blaine had become a senator. He did, and they lost by 4 votes. He didn't even show to vote. He had lost the presidential election before that vote had occurred, and his interest in it had waned at that point. But the Blaine Amendment lived on. It became a condition for statehood in many of the western states that were then coming into the Union. And how it was a condition was worked out in somewhat different ways from state to state. The U.S. Supreme Court, and so we have many states that now have some version of the Blaine Amendment, but the hallmark of the Blaine Amendment, a core Blaine Amendment, would say no aid to sectarian schools or no funds or support, public funds being used to support sectarian schools would be the core Blaine Amendment. And understand again, sectarian at least originally was largely code for Catholic. A majority of the members of the Supreme Court have now indicated that they find the Blaine history and the Blaine Amendment to have a shameful pedigree. In fact, in a plurality decision, the phrase was used by a plurality of the court was it was born of bigotry. So it's a highly controversial provision that shows up in a lot of state constitutions, and the remnants of Blaine, if you will, or the progeny of Blaine, shows up in Article 7, Section 1 of the Alaska Constitution. I'll come to that in just a moment. It is my opinion that the core Blaine Amendment is likely unconstitutional under the Equal Protection, Free Exercise clauses, and perhaps the fundamental right of parents to educate, to direct the education and upbringing of their children. So what happened in Alaska? Alaska, as you know, becomes a state relatively late in the process of the 50 states joining the Union. And in 1912, we have a territorial act passed by Congress, and this act had a provision in it, and this is the original organizing law for the territory of Alaska. And what this provision said, and I've quoted in paragraph 1E1 there of the document you have, it essentially says no use of public monies for any sectarian denomination or private school. So it's no aid to any privates, whether they be religious or secular private schools. Along comes, and Alaska as a territory operates under that until it becomes a state. Congress then issued a statehood act, Alaska Statehood Act in 1958. Section 6J of that act is what I would consider a pure Blaine provision, and it essentially says no aid to sectarian schools, no use of government funds for sectarian schools. It's not government funds in general. You can see it's a little more nuanced than that, but in deference to the committee's time, I'm not going to go into nuance on some of these things unless you have questions. So what we see coming from Congress is, in speaking to Alaska as it's forming as a state, is essentially Blaine language, that we want Blaine language in your document. So it's fascinating to me what Alaska did with that. So there are a number of legislative bodies in Alaska that have responded to this or made their own determination of what serves the public policy of Alaska. The first was the Constitutional Convention. And the Constitutional Convention adopted Article 7, Section 1. And what Article 7, Section 1 says is no direct aid. The debates of the Constitutional Convention make crystal clear that there was consideration of including a prohibition of no indirect aid. And the convention decided no direct aid. And it, as far as the flow of funds, it dropped out the sectarian focus, which was the anti-Catholic piece that was in the original Blaine movement. The Alaska Constitutional Convention rejected that type of consideration. There's a slight remnant of that where it says schools and institutions so established shall be free of sectarian control, but I've never heard of anyone propose that a particular church be in charge of the public schools, if you will. So that's what's in our Constitution, but then we have other Alaskan legislative bodies, both the legislature and the school boards essentially function as legislative bodies for their various school districts. So if you'd put your finger on page 2, but look to the appendix at the end of the document I've given you, I survey, and this is incomplete, I'm sure, but I survey in the middle column what some of the legislative declarations have been in Alaska. The territorial legislature in 1955 passed a bus transportation act that permitted buses that were taking kids to the public schools for kids going to private schools to hop on if it wasn't too far out of the way. That's a form of what I would call indirect aid. And so that's a declaration by the territorial legislation that regardless of what Congress said to them, that the territorial legislature supported indirect aid by its action. The Constitutional Convention we've already talked about essentially says no direct aid, but indirect aid is okay. Which by the way is more restrictive than federal constitutional law, but it is less restrictive than the Blaine impulse, if you will, which is part of why I head this column on legislative actions in Alaska as being Blaine-less. The legislature was this idea of being Blaine-like was put before the legislature with some legal force behind it, and again I see legislative bodies choosing not to be full-blown Blaine, in fact to have very little of the Blaine impulse in the legislation. 1968, we have this Tuition Grant Act. That's a statement by the legislature. Indirect aid is okay. That's the legislation issue in the Sheldon Jackson case we'll come to. 2004, the Alaska Advantage Education Grant, which is a form of indirect aid. It's my understanding that there's over 100 grants for between 2009 and 2013. We don't even have a complete list of those yet. Two private organizations by the legislature for various programs or facilities that are related to education or training. Those are direct grants by the legislature, a statement of the legislature's attitude about this. 2011, the Alaska Performance Scholarship, which is a form of indirect aid approved by the legislature. Then we have the school districts. And as I understand, and there was some discussion about this by the commissioner in the previous testimony, that the school districts contract with many private organizations. I presume there's a mix of for-profit and non-profit. There may even be some religious contractors in that mix. I don't know. But there's at least 122 on the chart that I've seen, and I hope the committee has received that in the past, showing different contracts purchasing educational supplementary services. That's a form, if we use this direct-indirect language, of direct, if you will. That's a direct contract with these providers. By the way, I want to say the word aid is somewhat deceptive because these are not grants to give someone money. It's hiring organizations to provide services. So it's not like giving food stamps, if you will, which I would consider aid to someone where we say go and buy food, whatever you want, buy some food. It is really a contract for services. And then finally in 2013, the charts we have indicate that there were 41 grants to private organizations for workforce development, and that's probably both a direct and indirect form of aid. Or form of movement, if you will, of public funds. So what the Alaska legislature has said, and I'm back on page 2 of the outline now, is that Alaska, the Alaska Constitutional Convention, the legislature, and the school boards, they have consistently, in my view, rejected the Blaine impulse, and what they've said instead is, we've got kids with needs. Who can best serve those needs? Let's all work together to help the kids with the needs. That's the choice that I see made by the representative bodies in Alaska. So then along comes the Alaska Supreme Court in 1961 in the Matthews versus Quinton case, and this case is, in my opinion, a little muddled, but it's worth time for the committee to read both the principal opinion and especially the dissent. It's a 2-1 decision. There were three justices, as I understand, on the court. And if we would say what the holding it is, the court struck down the 1955 Bus Transportation Act by the territorial legislature, and by implication it says, we're not going to permit direct or indirect aid. Well, when you have a state constitution in place by the time of this decision that specifically says direct aid is permissible, how then, you should wonder, did the Matthews Court reach that decision? And my view is that this is, and not just my view, but I think even the Supreme Court's later view, is that this is an extraordinarily result-oriented and legally erroneous decision that reversed the choice made by the territorial legislature and by the, effectively, by the Constitutional Convention. First, it's a 2-1 decision. Probably the most full-blown critique of it is Justice Diamond's dissent. And if you have a copy of the decision, I would urge you to look at footnote 20. This is in the subsequent Supreme Court case. So there's only two Supreme Court cases on this general subject matter. The second one is the Sheldon Jackson College case, and it contains, so when I first read Sheldon Jackson, I'm scanning it quickly to see what does the Supreme Court in 1979, the Sheldon Jackson decision, do with this earlier Matthews decision. It's the only precedent that would be controlling, and I read the text, and there's no mention of it whatsoever, and I think, well, this is just remarkable, but it's all explained in footnote 20. And in footnote 20, the Alaska Supreme Court said in 1979, it said of the 61 decision, we're declining to rely on Matthews. And they say, we do not rely on Matthews and thus have no occasion to overrule or reaffirm it. A substantial question, however, can be raised as to its continuing vitality in light of the analysis we employ in the present decision. They did everything but overrule it with that footnote. We're not going to cite it as a precedent, and oh, by the way, we're not affirming its continuing vitality, and its rationale is very different than the analysis we're using here. That was such a strong indicator that just months later, the Alaska Attorney General issued an opinion that the Matthews decision effectively has no effect on the use of public funds for school bus. So you, on the one hand, have a territorial statute overruled by the Alaska Supreme Court. The Attorney General says to the Supreme Court says to the territorial legislature, never mind. The Attorney General says to the Supreme Court, oh, never mind. And it's my understanding that there's funding for school buses that can take kids to private schools in Alaska to this day. Is that correct that there are?
Yes, there
funding
are.
Being used for, is that right?
That is so that, correct.
It's because of this confusing history. I think it's worth taking a moment to look at some of the kind of blatant errors in this decision. First, and perhaps most directly, the court redefines direct to mean indirect. I mean, it's a move by the court that it would not be fair, I would guess, fair play in how we ought to be doing law. What's not in the outline that should be is there's a recitation by the territorial legislature of why they passed the bill. And the Supreme Court said to the territorial legislature, you're wrong. That's not why you passed the bill. They said it was to help kids, whether they went to public or private schools, to get to school if they lived near the school bus route. And they said, well, because you didn't give every single private school kid a ride, those who live farthest out, therefore that must not have been your real purpose, the court reasoned. It also ignored I think there were like 8 different instances of discussion about this in the state constitutional convention. In other words, an extremely rich legislative history, and the majority opinion cites only one of those, which cut against the majority opinion, and then the court said there wasn't enough evidence to give any weight to what everybody was saying they thought they were doing in the state constitutional convention. A bit of yet another insult, if you will, to your constitutional convention. The next thing the court did is it relied upon the Organic Act, and it found that this 1955 law violated the Organic Act. But the Organic Act has no legal effect after you become a state. So it's relying upon a law that's effectively void at the time it invokes that. There's other problems with it. I'll just mention the last one, which is there is a United States Supreme Court decision directly on point involving bus transportation, which the Alaska Supreme Court was aware of in the Matthews decision. What to do about that? Most every court in the land knows they've got to defer to the U.S. Supremes. And the court tried to distinguish it a bit and essentially said, oh, it's not well written, and we're not going to defer to it. Just a remarkable decision. Justice Diamond, thank goodness, did not buy into this, and again, his dissent that begins on page 957 of the opinion is worth reading. So the next Supreme Court case then is the Sheldon Jackson case. We leap forward in time to 1979. And this case is considering another legislative act, this time by the Alaska legislature, not the territorial legislature, which, as you probably all know of this case, provided effectively a $2,500 scholarship. There's a little more nuance around it than that, for students attending private colleges. And the Sheldon Jackson court struck this down, holding that this constitutes direct aid, and thereby violates Article 7, Section 1. This decision is also highly problematic. Now, it does a couple of good things. One, it effectively says Matthews doesn't count. The second thing it does is it says clearly that the Constitutional Convention intended to permit indirect aid. So far, so good. But then what it does is it says, an indirect aid, by the way, would be aid where the family, whether it be the parents or the student, effectively direct how the money, where the money is applied. It's not a state decision where it's applied. It's a family decision. That's what indirect means. What this court did with that analysis, I'll come to in just a moment, but first it relies upon two Supreme Court precedents that were already highly questioned at that time, and in fact were subsequently overruled in Mitchell versus Helms. So the real core of this decision is built upon the Woolman versus Walter case and the Meek versus Pittenger case. Now that's interesting the court would choose those cases, because those are cases that involve aid to religious schools, where you have constitutional issues involving the Establishment Clause and so on that ought not be present if you have simply scholarships to any school out there. It's a different type of analysis. But even if that were not so, and those precedents were squarely overruled, which for that reason alone calls the Sheldon Jackson case into question. They were overruled by the Mitchell v. Helms case. So they really are the intellectual foundation for that case. The next, and I think the biggest problem with the Sheldon Jackson case, really goes to the core of why legislative bodies would want the freedom to decide whether vouchers were a good thing or not for their state. And so there was this idea all along that some of the constitutional problems would be less if it were indirect aid, that is, if the family or the student were making the decision which institution would benefit from this. The Sheldon Jackson Court on page 132 gives the back of its hand to this concept and says that this idea that using the student as an intermediary, that's the put-down language it uses, of where the funds would go, the idea that that would have a cleansing effect as far as legal concerns, the court rejects that out of hand. And what's remarkable about that is a very core concept to United States Supreme Court jurisprudence. And I set out just one example, which is the Mueller versus Allen decision from 1983. And this is a case that involved a Minnesota statute that provided tuition, textbook, and transportation expense tax credits for students whether they went to public or private schools. And let me, if you will indulge me, let me read you this long paragraph because I think it's worth the time. By channeling whatever assistance it may provide to parochial schools through individual parents, Minnesota has reduced the Establishment Clause objections. More about that in just a moment. It's true, of course, that financial assistance provided to parents ultimately has an economic effect comparable to that of aid given directly to the schools attended by the children. So the court's saying there that just the fact that there's a benefit to a religious school or a private school is not constitutionally significant because, of course, providing police and fire services provides an economic benefit, and that's not a constitutionally significant thing. The court then goes on to say, it is also true, however, that under Minnesota's arrangement, public funds become available only as a result of numerous private choices of individual parent school age children. And I've got a typo. I repeat that sentence. Whereas here, aid to parochial schools is available only as a result of the decisions of individual parents, no imprimatur of state approval can be deemed to have been conferred on any particular religion or religion generally. Now, what's important by that statement is the very core of an establishment of religion is the state choosing who's the ecclesiastical winner, right? So when we have the Church of England established by Henry VIII, he's deciding the ecclesiastical winner is the Church of England. And if you had, for example, a voucher program that said, this is only eligible for Lutheran schools and Lutheran students, you would be picking an ecclesiastical winner, and that would not be permitted. And having the parents decide where they send the kids inoculates the state from that problem. Because the parents are deciding private school, nonprofit private school, for-profit private school, religious school, homeschool, whatever is the choice that would be made in that. So for the Sheldon Court to say this doesn't matter is to act in derogation to probably a dozen U.S. Supreme Court decisions that give great significance to the fact that aid was indirect. So what we can say about the Constitutional Convention in Alaska, or what I would say is perhaps they were aware of this concept in its full-blown constitutional concept, or perhaps they intuited it through just good common sense that we don't want to be picking winners and losers, and that's why they rejected the sectarian limitation that Blaine offered and why they rejected the indirect limitation that Blaine, but it makes your constitutional convention, in my view, quite prescient in the decisions that they've made, and it also makes it clear that the Alaska Supreme Court has consistently overridden legislative choices and tried to revive the effect of Blaine. And while doing so, it has created an inconsistent, anomalous, and by that I mean it's Alaska-specific jurisprudence, especially with regard to whether a benefit is direct or indirect. So in conclusion, I would say I think the real issues before the court, pardon me, you see where I argue most of the time, before the legislature is the legislative branch independent of the judicial branch? The two major decisions in this area from admittedly different generations of the Alaska Supreme Court have acted, I think, in ways insulting to the Constitutional Convention and the legislature. The second question is, shall the legislature preserve the historical choices it, and by the way, all these school boards have made with regard to students' educational needs? I don't believe we have a complete inventory of the number of programs that, if challenged and taken to a court with the same disposition of the Sheldon Jackson Court, if, and I have no idea if you're present court has that disposition, that could not find a way to strike down every one of those and reject the choices of what constitutes good public policy made by the legislature and these school boards. And the third question is, shall the legislature preserve in the future its prerogatives based upon changing circumstances over time, decide what's best for the students of Alaska and their educational needs? So SJR 9 seems to me to be an excellent choice to resolve these issues and to put strong law in place that would preserve the prerogatives of the Alaska legislative bodies. Now, it does. The last thing I would point out is, my point Roman 6, is that the legislature would not, if it passes SJR 9 and would decide in some future session to look at some type of parochial aid, whether it be vouchers or something else. There's all sorts of types of programs around the country that, that states are adopting. But if it would decide to look at that, it still does not have license to do whatever it wishes. It would have to comply primarily with other state law regarding what would satisfy your compulsory education requirements. So you, I presume Alaska, like every state, has a compulsory education statute and has some broad definitions of what that would look like. And secondly, it's going to have to comply with the Establishment Clause, which is the primary clause that polices the boundaries between church and state. And the good news about that is there's probably 20, maybe somewhere between 16 and 20 U.S. Supreme Court decisions that provide guidance in this area so that you could have the legislature, the future legislatures could have a pretty good idea that what they're passing will pass constitutional muster. Thank you so much for hearing me out. You've been so generous time-wise, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Martin. Very thorough testimony, very thought-provoking, and I think even assigned homework. So, question, Senator Wilkowski has a question.
Yeah, thank you. Excellent presentation. Very, very informative. I'm an attorney also, and I can tell you that I've seen judges get it wrong. I've seen courts get it wrong. It's almost inevitably when I lose the case. And that's our system. It's a
yes.
System of checks and balances. And as you know, the Supreme Court has the final word. You can argue all you want, but they're the final word. And so that's the law of the land. You did raise one thing that sort of struck me, and that was your argument that this was a violation, that the Blaine Amendment was a violation of the First Amendment, because it was discriminating against religion, against religious institutions. And that struck me, and I did a quick search online, and I found a law review article, which I'm sure you've read or probably maybe have heard of. It's a Western New England law review article where it talks about the Blaine Amendment. And one of the argument, the thrust of the argument there is that if the United States Supreme Court ever were to find the Blaine Amendments unconstitutional, then a variety of other religious laws, such as laws targeting Mormon polygamy, would be found unconstitutional. And I'd be curious to hear your response to that.
Well, I don't see a link, because the Mormon polygamy cases, there's about 10 U.S. Supreme Court cases, some of which are directly on point. United States versus Reynolds would be the one that involved the criminal prosecution of a man involved in a plural marriage, and he challenged that on free exercise grounds, and the court said no. So that's a free exercise analysis. These type of cases are decided primarily on Establishment Clause analysis. Now, I'm not saying, by the way, that I think that the Article 7, Section 1 of the Alaska Constitution is unconstitutional. The Alaska Constitutional Convention, I believe, rejected much of what Blaine was about, but you have your state Supreme Court reinserting many of those Blaine-like values through its decisions. And I would, with all respect, take issue with your opening comment, which is that the Supreme Court has final word. When it is not uncommon around the country that when a court finds a legislative act contrary to law and the legislature believes strongly that it constitutes good public policy, that the legislature comes back and addresses that. So what you have in the two decisions in Alaska is, in my view, the Alaska Supreme Court undoing precisely what the Constitutional Convention intended and precisely what this legislature intended and these school boards have intended. So SJR 9 helps address that. So there is a built-in tension between the three branches of government, but when the Supreme Court speaks, it doesn't mean the legislature has to be silent.
And I would agree with you, and I'll just quote this: all political power is inherent in the people. All government originates with the people, is founded upon their will only, and is instituted solely for the good of the people as a whole. They have the right to amend their constitution. Thank you very much, Dr. Nussbaum. We have been given quite a bit of good information. Certainly is not the end of the debate, but it certainly gave us some good perspective. We'll be bringing this back up Monday. We have other bills that we'll bring back up Monday as well. However, for the committee members, don't leave the room. I've got the appointments that we are voted to recommend to the body. Would you please stick here and sign them? We will have further discussion on this. Thank you very much. We are now adjourned. Thank you.